Chapter 8. These theaters across the water made, in the sparsely twinkling masses of gloom an eastern town presents at night, blazing centers of light, and of a distant and howling uproar. I felt him become suddenly tractable again like an animal, like a good-tempered horse when the object that scares him is removed. Yes. I felt in the darkness there how tractable he was, without my conviction of his inflexibility tenacity, rather, perhaps being in the least weakened. His very arm abandoning itself to my grasp, was as hard as marble like a limb of iron. But I heard a tumultuous scuffling of boot soles within. The unspeakable idiots inside were crowding to the windows, climbing over each other's backs behind the blinds, billiard cues and all. Somebody broke a window pane, and with the sound of falling glass, so suggestive of riot and devastation, Schomburg reeled out after us in a state of funk which had prevented his parting with his brandy and soda. He must have trembled like an aspen leaf. The piece of ice in the long tumbler he held in his hand tinkled with an effect of chattering teeth. "Beg you, gentlemen," he expostulated thickly. Really, now, I must insist. How proud I am of my presence of mind. "Hallo," I said instantly in a loud and naive tone, "somebody's breaking your windows, Schomburg. Would you please tell one of your boys to bring out here a pack of cards and a couple of lights? And two long drinks. Will you?" To receive an order soothed him at once. It was business. "Certainly," he said in an immensely relieved tone. The night was rainy, with wandering gusts of wind, and while we waited for the canless Foxhead, as if to justify his panic, "I don't interfere in anybody's business. I don't give any occasion for talk. I am a respectable man. But this fellow is always making out something wrong, and can never rest till he gets somebody to believe him." This was the first of my knowledge of Fox. This desire of respectability, of being like everybody else, was the only recognition he vouchsafed to the organization of mankind. For the rest, he might have been the member of a herd, not of a society. Self-preservation was his only concern. Not selfishness, but mere self-preservation. Selfishness presupposes consciousness, choice, the presence of other men. But his instinct acted as though he were the last of mankind nursing that law like the only spark of a sacred fire. I don't mean to say that living naked in a cavern would have satisfied him. Obviously he was the creature of the conditions to which he was born. No doubt self-preservation meant also the preservation of these conditions. But essentially it meant something much more simple, natural, and powerful. How shall I express it? It meant the preservation of the five senses of his body, let us say taking it in its narrowest as well as in its widest meaning. I think you will admit before long the justice of this judgment. However, as we stood there together in the dark veranda, I had judged nothing as yet, and I had no desire to judge, which is an idle practice anyhow. The light was long in coming. "Of course," I said in a tone of mutual understanding, "it isn't exactly a game of cards I want with you." I saw him draw his hands down his face, the vague stir of the passionate and meaningless gesture, but he waited in silent patience. It was only when the lights had been brought out that he opened his lips. I understood his mumble to mean that he didn't know any game. "Like this Schomburg and all the other fools will have to keep off," I said, tearing open the pack. "Have you heard that we are universally supposed to be quarreling about a girl? You know who, of course. I am really ashamed to ask, but is it possible that you do me the honor to think me dangerous?" As I said these words, I felt how absurd it was, and also I felt flattered, for, really, what else could it be? His answer, spoken in his usual dispassionate undertone, made it clear that it was so, but not precisely as flattering as I supposed. He thought me dangerous with Herman, more than with the girl herself. But, as to quarreling, I saw at once how inappropriate the word was. We had no quarrel. Natural forces are not quarrelsome. You can't quarrel with the wind, that inconveniences and humiliates you by blowing off your hat in a street full of people. He had no quarrel with me. Neither would a boulder, falling on my head, have had. He fell upon me in accordance with the law by which he was moved not of gravitation, like a detached stone, but of self-preservation. Of course this is giving it a rather wide interpretation. Strictly speaking, he had existed, and could have existed without being married. Yet he told me that he had found it more and more difficult to live alone. Yes. He told me this in his low, careless voice. To such a pitch of confidence had we arrived at the end of half an hour. It took me just about that time to convince him that I had never dreamed of marrying Herman's niece. Could any necessity have been more extravagant? And the difficulty was the greater because he was so hard hit that he couldn't imagine anybody being able to remain in a state of indifference. Any man with eyes in his head, he seemed to think, could not help coveting so much bodily magnificence. This profound belief was conveyed by the manner he listened sitting sideways to the table and playing absently with a few cards I had dealt to him at random. And the more I saw into him, the more I saw of him. The wind swayed the lights so that his sunburnt face, whiskered to the eyes, seemed to successively flicker crimson at me and to go out. I saw the extraordinary breadth of the high cheekbones, the perpendicular style of the features, the massive forehead, steep like a cliff, denuded at the top, largely uncovered at the temples. The fact is I had never before seen him without his hat, but now, as if my fervor had made him hot, he had taken it off and laid it gently on the floor. Something peculiar in the shape and setting of his yellow eyes gave them the provoking silent intensity which characterized his glance. But the face was thin, furrowed, worn. I discovered that through the bush of his hair, as you may detect the gnarled shape of a tree trunk lost in a dense undergrowth. These overgrown cheeks were sunken. It was an Ancherite's bony head fitted with a capuchin's beard and adjusted to a Herculean body. I don't mean athletic. Hercules, I take it, was not an athlete. He was a strong man, susceptible to female charms, and not afraid of dirt. And thus with Falk, who was a strong man. He was extremely strong, just as the girl, since I must think of them together, was magnificently attractive by the masterful power of flesh and blood, expressed in shape, in size, in attitude that is by a straight appeal to the senses. His mind, meantime, preoccupied with respectability, quailed before Schomburg's tongue and seemed absolutely impervious to my protestations. And I went so far as to protest that I would just as soon think of marrying my mother's dear old lady, faithful female cook as Herman's niece. Sooner, I protested, in my desperation, much sooner, but it did not appear that he saw anything outrageous in the proposition, and in his skeptical immobility he seemed to nurse the argument that at all events the cook was very, very far away. It must be said that, just before, I had gone wrong by appealing to the evidence of my manner whenever I called on board the Diana. I had never attempted to approach the girl, or to speak to her, or even to look at her in any marked way. Nothing could be clearer. But, as his own idea of, let us say, courting, seemed to consist precisely in sitting silently for hours in the vicinity of the beloved object, that line of argument inspired him with distrust. Staring down his extended legs, he let out a grunt as much as to say, "That's all very fine, but you can't throw dust in my eyes." At last I was exasperated into saying, "Why don't you put the matter at rest by talking to her, man?" And I added sneeringly, "You don't expect me perhaps to speak for you?" To this he said, very loud for him, "Would you?" And for the first time he lifted his head, to look at me with wonder and incredulity. He lifted his head so sharply that there could be no mistake. I had touched a spring. I saw the whole extent of my opportunity, and could hardly believe in it. "Why? Speak to?" Well, of course, I proceeded very slowly, watching him with great attention, for, on my word, I feared a joke. odd, perhaps, to the young lady herself. I can't speak German, you know. But, Dot, he interrupted me with the earnest assurance that Hermann had the highest opinion of me, and at once I felt the need for the greatest possible diplomacy at this juncture. So I demurred just enough to draw him on. Fox sat up, but except for a very noticeable enlargement of the pupils, till the irises of his eyes were reduced to two narrow yellow rings, his face, I should judge, was incapable of expressing excitement. H, yes. Hermann did have the greatest. Dot, take up your cards. Here's Schomburg peeping at us through the blind, I said. We went through the motions of what might have been a game of Eckert. Presently the intolerable scandalmonger withdrew, probably to inform the people in the billiard room that we two were gambling on the veranda like mad. We were not gambling, but it was a game in which I felt I held the winning cards. The stake, roughly speaking, was the success of the voyage for me, and he, I apprehended, had nothing to lose. Our intimacy matured rapidly, and before many words had been exchanged I perceived that the excellent Hermann had been making use of me. That simple and astute Teuton had been, it seems, holding me up to Falk in the light of a rival. I was young enough to be shocked at so much duplicity. Did he tell you that in so many words? I asked with indignation. Hermann had not. He had given hints only. And of course it had not taken very much to alarm Falk, but, instead of declaring himself, he had taken steps to remove the family from under my influence. He was perfectly straightforward about it, as straightforward as a tile falling on your head. There was no duplicity in that man, and when I congratulated him on the perfection of his arrangements even to the bribing of the wretched Johnson against me, he had a genuine movement of protest. Never bribed. He knew the man wouldn't work, as long as he had a few cents in his pocket to get drunk on, and, naturally, he said naturally, he let him have a dollar or two. He was himself a sailor, he said, and anticipated the view another sailor, like myself, was bound to take. On the other hand, he was sure that I should have to come to grief. He hadn't been knocking about for the last 7 years up and down that river for nothing. It would have been no disgrace to me, but he asserted confidently I would have had my ship very awkwardly ashore at a spot 2 miles below the Great Pagoda. ... And with all that, he had no ill will. That was evident. This was a crisis in which his only object had been to gain time, I fancy. And presently he mentioned that he had written for some jewelry, real good jewelry, had written to Hong Kong for it. It would arrive in a day or two. Well then, I said cheerily, everything is all right. All you've got to do is to present it to the lady together with your heart, and live happy ever after. Upon the whole, he seemed to accept that view as far as the girl was concerned, but his eyelids drooped. There was still something in the way. For one thing, Hermann disliked him so much. As to me, on the contrary, it seemed as though he could not praise me enough. Mrs. Hermann too. He didn't know why they disliked him so. It made everything most difficult. I listened impassive, feeling more and more diplomatic. His speech was not transparently clear. He was one of those men who seem to live, feel, suffer in a sort of mental twilight. But as to being fascinated by the girl, and possessed by the desire of home life with her, it was as clear as daylight. So much being at stake, he was afraid of putting it to the hazard of declaration. Besides, there was something else. And with Hermann being so set against him. I see, I said thoughtfully, while my heart beat fast with the excitement of my diplomacy. Don't mind sounding Hermann. In fact, to show you how mistaken you were, I am ready to do all I can for you in that way. A light sigh escaped him. He drew his hands down his face, and it emerged, bony, unchanged of expression, as if all the tissues had been ossified. All the passion was in those big brown hands. He was satisfied. Then there was that other matter. If there were anybody on earth, it was I who could persuade Hermann to take a reasonable view. I had a knowledge of the world and lots of experience. Herman admitted this himself. And then? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.